Insperity presents the Small Business Advocate Show with Jim Blasingame. This is a copyrighted production of Small Business Network, Inc. All rights reserved.
Now back to Ringside with the voice of small business and the champion of the entrepreneur.
Say it now, gentlemen. Undisputed heavyweight champion of the world.
The Small Business Advocate, Jim Blasingame.
We're back. It's 34 after. Thanks for hanging around with us. Thomas Barnett, ladies and gentlemen, is our guest this half hour. Thomas is a senior strategic researcher and professor at the U.S. Naval War College. From 2001 to 2003, he served as assistant for Strategic Futures Office of Force Transformation, Office of the Secretary of Defense. And he's been studying something that we're going to talk about during his visit for some time now. He's the author of a new book called The Pentagon's New Map, War and Peace in the 21st Century. And one of the things he's going to help us discuss today, going to help us understand today, is how this Pentagon's new map is something that small business owners need to be paying attention to. Tom Barnett, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
It's good to have you here. Tom, one of the most interesting things for me has been to observe the world after the end of the Cold War. As a baby boomer, you know, I grew up in the Cold War, and I remember my father and mother debating whether we should have a fallout shelter, and you know, and all
right.
That. I remember sitting in my front yard watching the Sputnik go overhead, and
right.
And you know, and all that kind of thing. And then you know, in the late 80s, basically the Cold War ended with the fall of the Soviet Union. But and a lot of people mark their lives, you know, pre 9/11 and post 9/11. But there's also another era, and that is pre the end of Cold War, and then after the Cold War, and you talk about that a lot in your book.
Right. I mean, it's been a real change for us looking at the world and trying to figure out, in effect, where danger is and what we need to protect ourselves against. We in the Pentagon got so used to the notion of we need to plan a war against another great power who has a huge military, a huge technologically sophisticated military, looks much like our own, because that's what we did across the Cold War. We basically sized our forces on the basis of what we saw the Soviets had.
Mm-hmm.
Soviets go away in 1990. We're kind of flabbergasted for several years. We look around the world and we see chaos, we see uncertainty, and you know, that kind of strategic vision is almost the lack of any strategic vision. It's, you can't defend everything against everything. You have to sort of decide what's really worth fighting for and where you really have to wage the peace to make the world a safer place.
We sort of played the Pollyanna Glad game, didn't we? We were so excited about the peace dividend that we were going to accrue from the end of the Cold War, that we sort of went to sleep on another great evil that was building up, didn't we?
Yeah, on some level, and we looked in the wrong places for that peace dividend. It wasn't necessarily that we were going to reduce our defense budget so dramatically, but simply take advantage globally of the new markets that came online dramatically. I mean, and it really goes back to almost the early 1980s when a China begins to open up under
right.
Deng Xiaoping, and you see an India start moving in this fashion, the Berlin Wall comes down. I mean, there was a whole bunch of a huge swath of humanity, almost half the global population, that sort of came online and joined the global economy in the last 10, 15, 20 years. That was a huge opportunity that we saw, and that's where I think a lot of the hope came about. But at the same time, you couldn't forget where the global economy hadn't connected up societies, where there were regions or countries that were still, as I say, you know, noses pressed to the glass, looking at this grand party we call the global economy, not feeling part of it, and over time becoming angry on that basis.
Are those the people you call the lesser includeds?
Well, the lesser included concept basically says we have planned so long for the big one, the big war against the Soviets, that we have a tendency to kind of stay fixated on that. And frankly, inside the Pentagon around the mid-1990s, we traded in the old Soviet threat, and we decided it was going to be China who was going to be our long-term, mm-hmm. as we call it, near-peer competitor. That's a little troubling from a business perspective. I ran workshops on Wall Street, actually in the World Trade Center, up on top, where we brought together at the end of the century, Wall Street heavyweights, national security types, and we talked about the future of the world. And what was scary about where things were going in my mind was you had the Pentagon looking at China as the future of global conflict and planning for war, in effect, against a China or a China-like entity downstream, maybe 20 or 30 years, because that was a familiar image, big, bad communist. Mm-hmm. But you also had the business world, Wall Street, Main Street, interacting with China on a dramatically increased level across the 1990s, to the point where China is one of the biggest trade partners we have now,
right?
Biggest source of our foreign trade deficit, one of the biggest buyers
and
of U.S. Treasury bonds.
And one of our biggest competitors, too,
for
a number of things, not only for finished goods, but for raw materials. Folks, Tom Barnett has and his group have drawn a map, a new map that he calls the Pentagon's new map. And we're going to get him to talk to us about that new map, especially as it overlays our future interest for trade as small business owners. And we're going to do that right after these messages. 20 till. Stay with us. We'll be right back with Thomas Barnett, the author of The Pentagon's New Map. USA. We're back. It's 17 till. I'm Jim Blasingame, the Small Business Advocate, and we're visiting with our new friend, Tom Barnett. Thomas P.M. Barnett is the name on the book, The Pentagon's New Map, World and Peace in the 21st Century. Tom, you've got a map here. Folks, this map is worth the price of the book. It's very interesting. It's on the back covers and the front cover. on the inside, I should say, on the inside of the cover. Tell us about the map.
The map really begins with a simple series of observations. What we did was we plotted on a global map all the places we sent U.S. military forces since the end of the Cold War. It's almost 150 different interventions, which is a huge growth in terms of activity and in terms of duration of these individual interventions. And what we did is I simply drew a line around the majority of those interventions. And I said, what is that shape first? And it's a shape that basically stretches from the Caribbean Rim and the Andes portion of South America, covers most of Africa, goes up and grabs the Balkans, the Caucasus, the Central Asian republics, the Middle East, and much of Southeast Asia. So a big kind of equatorially centered swath of humanity, roughly
one-third.
It looks like
a House of Representatives district in Texas is what it looks like. Talk about gerrymandering.
Well, what I say is, you know, the Soviets go away. That's the natural demand pattern that emerges when the Cold War ends for what I call the exporting of U.S. security. Okay, that's where the world seems to draw us in terms of where we can bring stability, where we can try to export security, where we can try to bring peace. And what's important about understanding those regions, which I call in aggregate the non-integrating gap, I call them that because these regions, these countries, are some of the least connected to the global economy, some of the most disconnected from the outside world. And that really brings about this notion that I describe as the security paradigm of the age. Disconnectedness defines danger.
Mm-hmm. Well, and so if you look at a lot of these areas, there's a lot of illiteracy in those areas. I mean, you got a lot of Africa, including, you know, Saudi Arabia is one of the most illiterate countries in the world, isn't it?
You're going to find illiteracy. You're going to find women treated more poorly. You're going to find a tougher plight for young children. You're going to find all the genocide, all the ethnic cleansing, all the wars, all the civil wars, all the authoritarian regimes that we really worry about, almost all the terrorist groups that we really worry about. Virtually all the violence in the world is inside that neck of the woods. So I say you want to get rid of the violence, and the violence that creates and breeds the terrorists that we worry about, you got to make globalization global. You got to connect those disconnected areas.
Well, and the thing is, folks, when you look at this map, the non-integrated gap, he also identifies it on the map. Some of those places are very, very near to our shore, aren't they, Tom?
Right. And you know, one of the things we have to think about as we talk about shrinking this gap is understanding that globalization is dominated by massive flows that have to be kept roughly in balance. And what I mean by that is you have to let these resources flow from areas of surplus to areas of deficit. Here's a key one. That rest of the world that I call the functioning core of globalization, that world, birth rates are dropping. and that population is aging. Whereas when I talk about this non-integrating gap, we're talking about population explosion. Mm-hmm. So as that core, as I describe it, gets older and depopulates, you're going to see a tremendous flow of people from the gap to that core over time. So this has huge implications for immigration, for labor pools, and when we wage a war on terrorism that leads to tighter restrictions on the movement of people across that global system, we're altering some really dramatic aspects of our future economic situation. The Census Bureau predicts that two-thirds of the population growth in this country in the next 40, 50 years is going to be Latinos immigrating out from Central and South America. We've already seen in the aftermath of 9/11 with the tighter immigration controls that a certain portion of that flow is redirecting to Europe. Okay, that's going to change the labor mix. That's going to present challenges to the way we deal with labor and the assumptions we make about, you know, how we're going to have enough workers to retirees to maintain a decent ratio so our Social Security, our Medicare, and these other things are properly funded.
You paint globalization with a much broader brush, much more multifaceted, I think, than most people do, don't you?
Absolutely. I mean, I think one of the sins we committed, you know, one of the things we failed to imagine across the 90s, we just sort of assumed that globalization would sweep the planet on its own, that all the trade barriers would fall and everybody would connect up, and there wouldn't be any sort of violence or instability as part of this process. And what I say is, in effect, globalization needs a bodyguard. It can't spread into some of these insecure areas unless you take out and deal with the security deficits, the security bad actors in that region, because the money won't flow there and the business won't follow.
You also say, though, and here's a quote, I think I found it, whether we realize it or not, America serves as the ideological wellspring for globalization. If that's true, and you say globalization needs a bodyguard, are we the people to do the bodyguarding?
Well, we're the only country that really has a military force that can go abroad and project power in any meaningful way beyond our shores.
Well, that's what we're doing. That's what we're doing, Tom. But there are a lot of people in America who disagree with that premise, who don't want to do that, who don't want America to be the guardian of globalization. What do you say to those people?
What I say to those people is we've tried that route before. We had an expansive period of globalization at the end of the last century, and it was humming along right up to the First World War. And at the end of that First World War, there needed to be somebody who stepped up and said, you know, this is a process worth saving, this integration. We can't let it just all fall apart. Nobody did that. The United States pulled back from the world, and what we got for that isolationist attitude was a Great Depression and World War II.
That's right. Containment and appeasement don't work, ladies and gentlemen. That's been proven over and over again. We got at least 100 years of that evidence. When we come back, we're going to focus a little more on trade and the globalization with some of the things that Tom talks about in his book, The Pentagon's New Map, available wherever books are sold. Stay with us, Tintel. We're back at 7-2. I'm Jim Blasingame, the Small Business Advocate. Thank you very much for hanging around with us today. Let me remind you, coming up in the show straight ahead, we're going to have our FedWatch show with Michael Menzies and Richard DeKayser, two of our favorite bankers in the Brain Trust. We're going to talk about what the Fed's job is going to be coming up in their next meeting, which is on Tuesday. Then after that, we're going to be visiting with Brad Huskin and Christina Cavanaugh, and I'll tell you more about them a little bit later on. It's almost 7-2. Or it actually is a little beyond 7-2. We're visiting with Tom Barnett. Thomas P.M. Barnett is the name on the book, The Pentagon's New Map, War and Peace in the 21st Century. Tom, is there a website you'd like to direct us to?
It's www.thomaspmbarnett.com.
Okay, all together and no periods or anything like that in there. So, you've been talking to, off the air a little bit, you told me, and you indicated, you inferred it a little bit on the air, Tom, that you saw opportunity for small business in the future of not only globalization, obviously the trade of globalization, but also the bodyguard of globalization.
Right. I mean, I think we're shifting from a paradigm where we're going to buy huge weapon systems and platforms to wage war against a huge military opponent, which is the way we've planned our military for a long time. So defense contracting was dominated by huge corporations that built these huge,
A handful.
Bizarrely expensive bits of equipment. I think we're heading towards something a lot closer to a policing sort of model for the world. We're going to do a lot more peacekeeping, disaster relief, crisis response, nation building.
Education.
So as we become less the warfighter and more the police force, I think we're shifting from the paradigm of buying the few and the cheap to the many and the inexpensive. And so you're going to see procurement opportunities, I think, that are going to be much more broadly based, that are going to involve DOD buying lots of little things that have to do with, say, like body armor or non-lethal weapons
right.
and technologies, ways to armor vehicles, ways to deal with crowd control. So a lot of the same procurement opportunities for small businesses that I think you're familiar with if you've ever dealt with municipal police departments or emergency response systems or fire departments.
So you're basically saying
the possibilities.
The Department of Defense is going to be focusing on vendor. You know, over the last 20 years, corporations have been doing something called vendor reduction, where they've gone to fewer
right.
and fewer vendors. And you're saying that the Department of Defense is going to be going to vendor expansion.
I think so, because I think the pool of assets that they're going to need to tap to make the Defense Department not just the world's best military warfighting force, but also beef up those capabilities in the peace waging part,
right.
the nation building and everything else, they're going to have to tap a much wider array of assets and capabilities, and that's going to open up the pool of potential contractors dramatically, I think.
One of the things that's happening concurrently right now, Tom, that I think that plays into perfectly into what you're saying, and that is the unbundling of all these contracts that the government has been letting in the past, where they would do business with one major corporation and let them pick out their small businesses that they do business with. The unbundling opens it up to any small business, and the
right.
SBA is doing a good job with their business matchmaking programs across the country, where they're inviting small businesses to come in. They're literally sitting them down in front of the people you're talking about who are buying some of these technologies and some of these systems and these smaller products. They're actually putting those small business owners with those people that you're talking about who are going to be the customers. The purchasers.
You can see the demand when you see U.S. soldiers buying on eBay or Amazon or some online situation, you know, that special glove they want or that special backpack they want
right.
or that special radio phone or whatever it is. I mean, when you see the military reaching out on their own individually trying to grab
right.
these things off the marketplace, it tells you that the procurement paradigm that we've been working on just isn't working. So we have to open it up, I think, dramatically.
Now, you're teaching at the Naval College. Naval
yes.
War College, are they listening to you? I know they're paying you to think about these things, to look into the future, but are they listening to you?
Well, you know, I get the chance to brief all over the country in terms of the military, and I get a chance and the opportunity to brief foreign militaries a tremendous amount. And what I hear throughout the U.S. military and from foreign militaries is that move towards beefing up our capacity to do peacekeeping and nation building and all that kind of stuff, which frankly has been the rising workload across the 90s that we did not balance our force to account for, they're very open to these ideas because they see that as the future. And frankly, when we talk to allies, that's the capabilities they bring to bear most effectively. They're not able to wage big-time war against some big enemy.
Right.
They have small militaries. They tend to be more police-oriented, mm-hmm. more Coast Guard-like in their navies.
Mm-hmm.
So this fits their paradigm perfectly, and it really speaks to more burden sharing and being able to attract more coalition partners by showing that we're committed.
Tom Barnett, I've got to stop you because we run out of time, but I've really enjoyed getting into your book. Thank you for the time that you've given us today. The book is called The Pentagon's New Map. Thanks, Tom, for being here.
Thank you for having me.
All right, we'll get you back again another day. Got to go for this hour. Before I do, I want to thank my heroes, small business owners. This is Jim Blasingame. I'll see you later.
Insperity presents the Small Business Advocate Show with Jim Blasingame. This is a copyrighted production of Small Business Network, Inc., intended for the private use of our audience. Except as otherwise provided by copyright law, all other copying, redistribution, or publication without prior written consent is prohibited. All rights reserved.